Chapter 4. It was nearly 6 years after the departure of Mr. David Foe for the West Indies that the vacant shop in the marketplace at Grimworth was understood to have been let to the stranger with a sallow complexion and a buff cravat, whose first appearance had caused some excitement in the bar of the Woolpack, where he had called to wait for the coach. Grimworth, to a discerning eye, was a good place to set up shopkeeping in. There was no competition in it at present, the church people at their own grocer and draper, the dissenters at theirs, and the two or three butchers found a ready market for their joints without strict reference to religious persuasion, except that the rector's wife had given a general order for the veal sweetbreads and the mutton kidneys, while Mr. Rodd, the Baptist minister, had requested that, so far as was compatible with the fair accommodation of other customers, the sheep's trotters might be reserved for him. And it was likely to be a growing place, for the trustees of Mr. Zephania Cripps' charity, under the stimulus of a late visitation by commissioners, were beginning to apply long accumulating funds to the rebuilding of the Yellow Coat School, which was henceforth to be carried forward on a greatly extended scale, the testator having left no restrictions concerning the curriculum, but only concerning the coat. The shopkeepers at Grimworth were by no means unanimous as to the advantages promised by this prospect of increased population and trading, being substantial men who liked doing a quiet business in which they were sure of their customers and could calculate their returns to a nicety. Hitherto, it had been held a point of honor by the families in Grimworth Parish to buy their sugar and their flannel at the shop, where their fathers and mothers had bought before them. But, if newcomers were to bring in the system of neck-and-neck trading, and solicit feminine eyes by gown pieces laid in fan-like folds, and surmounted by artificial flowers, giving them a factitious charm, for on what human figure would a gown sit like a fan, or what female head was like a bunch of china asters? Or, if new grocers were to fill their windows with mountains of currants and sugar, made seductive by contrast and tickets, what security was there for Grimworth that a vagrant spirit in shopping, once introduced, would not in the end carry the most important families to the larger market town of Cattleton, where, business being done on a system of small profits and quick returns, the fashions were of the freshest, and goods of all kinds might be bought at an advantage. With this view of the times predominant among the tradespeople at Grimworth, their uncertainty concerning the nature of the business which the sallow-complexioned stranger was about to set up in the vacant shop, naturally gave some additional strength to the fears of the less sanguine. If he was going to sell drapery, it was probable that a pale-faced fellow like that would deal in showy and inferior articles, printed cottons, and muslins which would leave their dye in the wash tub, jobbed linen full of knots, and flannel that would soon look like gauze. If grocery, then it was to be hoped that no mother of a family would trust the teas of an untried grocer. Such things had been known in some parishes as tradesmen going about canvassing for custom with cards in their pockets. When people came from nobody knew where, there was no knowing what they might do. It was a thousand pities that Mr. Moffat, the auctioneer and broker, had died without leaving anybody to follow him in the business, and Mrs. Cleve's trustee ought to have known better than to let a shop to a stranger. Even the discovery that ovens were being put up on the premises, and that the shop was, in fact, being fitted up for a confectioner and pastry cook's business, hitherto unknown in Grimworth, did not quite suffice to turn the scale in the newcomer's favor, though the landlady at the Woolpack defended him warmly, said he seemed to be a very clever young man, and from what she could make out, came of a very good family, indeed, was most likely a good many people's betters. It certainly made a blaze of light and color, almost as if a rainbow had suddenly descended into the marketplace, when, one fine morning, the shutters were taken down from the new shop, and the two windows displayed their decorations. On one side, there were the variegated tints of colored and marbled meats, set off by bright green leaves, the pale brown of glazed pies, the rich tones of sauces and bottled fruits enclosed in their veil of glass altogether a sight, to bring tears into the eyes of a Dutch painter. And on the other, there was a predominance of the more delicate hues of pink, and white, and yellow, and buff, in the abundant lozenges, candies, sweet biscuits and icings, which to the eyes of a bilious person might easily have been blended into a fiery landscape in Turner's latest style. What a sight to dawn upon the eyes of Grimworth children! They almost forgot to go to their dinner that day, their appetites being preoccupied with imaginary sugar plums. And I think even Punch, setting up his tabernacle in the marketplace, would not have succeeded in drawing them away from those shop windows, where they stood according to gradations of size and strength, the biggest and strongest being nearest the window, and the little ones in the outermost rows lifting wide open eyes, and mouths towards the upper tier of jars, like small birds at mealtime. The elder inhabitants pished, and sawed a little at the folly of the new shopkeeper in venturing on such an outlay in goods that would not keep. To be sure, Christmas was coming, but what housewife in Grimworth would not think shame to furnish forth her table with articles that were not home-cooked? No, no. Mr. Edward Freely, as he called himself, was deceived if he thought Grimworth money was to flow into his pockets on such terms. Edward Freely was the name that shone in gilt letters on a Mazarin ground over the doorplace of the new shop, a generous-sounding name that might have belonged to the open-hearted, improvident hero of an old comedy who would have delighted in raining sugared almonds, like a new man a gift, among that small generation outside the windows. But Mr. Edward Freely was a man whose impulses were kept in due subordination. He held that the desire for sweets and pastry must only be satisfied in a direct ratio with the power of paying for them. If the smallest child in Grimworth would go to him with a halfpenny in its tiny fist, he would, after ringing the halfpenny, deliver a just equivalent in ock. He was not a man to cheat even the smallest child, he often said so, observing at the same time that he loved honesty, and also that he was very tender-hearted, though he didn't show his feelings as some people did. Either in reward of such virtue, or according to some more hidden law of sequence, Mr. Freely's business, in spite of prejudice, started under favorable auspices. For Mrs. Chaloner, the rector's wife, was among the earliest customers at the shop, thinking it only right to encourage a new parishioner who had made a decorous appearance at church, and she found Mr. Freely a most civil, obliging young man, and intelligent to a surprising degree for a confectioner, well principled too, for in giving her useful hints about choosing sugars he had thrown much light on the dishonesty of other tradesmen. Moreover, he had been in the West Indies, and had seen the very estate which had been her poor grandfather's property, and he said the missionaries were the only cause of the Negro's discontent, an observing young man, evidently. Mrs. Chaloner ordered wine, biscuits and olives, and gave Mr. Freely to understand that she should find his shop a great convenience. So did the doctor's wife, and so did Mrs. Gate, at the large carding mill, who, having high connections frequently visiting her, might be expected to have a large consumption of ratafias and macaroons. The less aristocratic matrons of Grimworth seemed likely at first to justify their husbands' confidence that they would never pay a percentage of profits on drop cakes, instead of making their own, or get up a hollow show of liberal housekeeping by purchasing slices of collared meat when a neighbor came in for supper. But it is my task to narrate the gradual corruption of Grimworth manners from their primitive simplicity, a melancholy task, if it were not cheered by the prospect of the fine peripatia or downfall by which the progress of the corruption was ultimately checked. It was young Mrs. Steen, the veterinary surgeon's wife, who first gave way to temptation. I fear as he had been rather overeducated for her station in life, for she knew by heart many passages in Lalaruk, the Corsair, and the Siege of Corinth, which had given her a distaste for domestic occupations, and caused her a withering disappointment at the discovery that Mr. Steen, since his marriage, had lost all interest in the oboe, openly preferred discussing the nature of spavin with a coarse neighbor, and was angry, if the pudding turned out watery indeed, was simply a top-booted head, comma who came in hungry at dinner time, and not in the least like a nobleman turned corsair out of pure scorn for his race, or like a renegade with a turban and crescent, unless it were in the irritability of his temper. And scorn is such a very different thing in top boots. This brutal man had invited a supper party for Christmas Eve, when he would expect to see mince pies on the table. Mrs. Steen had prepared her mince meat, and had devoted much butter, fine flour, and labor, to the making of a batch of pies in the morning, but they proved to be so very heavy, when they came out of the oven, that she could only think with trembling of the moment, when her husband should catch sight of them on the supper table. He would storm at her, she was certain, and before all the company, and then she should never help crying. It was so dreadful, to think as he had come to that, after the bubble and everything. Suddenly the thought darted through her mind, that this once she might send for a dish of mince pies from Freely's. She knew he had some. But what was to become of the 18 heavy mince pies? Oh, it was of no use thinking about that. It was very expensive indeed. Making mince pies at all was a great expense, when they were not sure to turn out well. It would be much better to buy them ready-made. You paid a little more for them, but there was no risk of waste. Such was the sophistry with which this misguided young woman enough. Mrs. Steen sent for the mince pies, and, I am grieved to add, garbled her household accounts in order to conceal the fact from her husband. This was the second step in a downward course, all owing to a young woman's being out of harmony with her circumstances, yearning after renegades and bubbles, and being subject to claims from a veterinary surgeon fond of mince pies. The third step was to harden herself, by telling the fact of the bought mince pies to her intimate friend Mrs. Mole, who had already guessed it, and who subsequently encouraged herself in buying a mold of jelly, instead of exerting her own skill, by the reflection that other people did the same sort of thing. The infection spread. Soon there was a party or clique in Grimworth on the side of eyeing at Freely's, and many husbands, kept for some time in the dark on this point, innocently swallowed at two mouthfuls a tart on which they were paying a profit of 100%, and as innocently encouraged a fatal disingenuousness in the partners of their bosoms by praising the pastry. Others, more keen-sighted, winked at the too frequent presentation on washing days, and at impromptu suppers, of superior spiced beef, which flattered their palates more than the cold remnants they had formerly been contented with. Every housewife who had once audited Freely's felt a secret joy when she detected a similar perversion in her neighbor's practice, and soon only two or three old-fashioned mistresses of families held out in the protest against the growing demoralization, saying to their neighbors who came to sup with them, "I can't offer you Freely's beef, or Freely's cheesecakes. Everything in our house is homemade. I'm afraid you'll hardly have any appetite for our plain pastry." The doctor, whose cook was not satisfactory, the curate, who kept no cook, and the mining agent, who was a great bon vivant, even began to rely on Freely for the greater part of their dinner, when they wished to give an entertainment of some brilliancy. In short, the business of manufacturing the more fanciful viands was fast passing out of the hinds of maids and matrons in private families, and was becoming the work of a special commercial organ. I am not ignorant that this sort of thing is called the inevitable course of civilization, division of labor, and so forth, and that the maids and matrons may be said to have had their hands set free from cookery, to add to the wealth of society in some other way. Only it happened at Grimworth, which, to be sure, was a low place, that the maids and matrons could do nothing with their hands at all better than cooking. not even those who had always made heavy cakes and leathery pastry. And so it came to pass that the progress of civilization at Grimworth was not otherwise apparent than in the impoverishment of men, the gossiping idleness of women, and the heightening prosperity of Mr. Edward Freely. The Yellow Coat School was a double source of profit to the calculating confectioner, for he opened an eating room for the superior workmen employed on the new school, and he accommodated the pupils at the old school by giving great attention to the fancy sugar department. When I think of the sweet-tasted swans, and other ingenious white shapes crunched by the small teeth of that rising generation, I am glad to remember that a certain amount of calcareous food has been held good for young creatures whose bones are not quite formed, for I have observed these delicacies to have an inorganic flavor which would have recommended them greatly to that young lady of the Spectator's acquaintance who habitually made her dessert on the stems of tobacco pipes. As for the confectioner himself, he made his way gradually into Grimworth homes, as his commodities did, in spite of some initial repugnance. Somehow or other, his reception as a guest seemed a thing that required justifying, like the purchasing of his pastry. In the first place, he was a stranger, and therefore open to suspicion. Secondly, the confectionery business was so entirely new at Grimworth that its place in the scale of rank had not been distinctly ascertained. There was no doubt about drapers and grocers, when they came of good old Grimworth families, like Mr. Luff and Mr. Prettyman. They visited with the Palfreys, who farmed their own land, played many a game at whist with the doctor, and condescended a little towards the timber merchant, who had lately taken to the coal trade also, and had got new furniture. But whether a confectioner should be admitted to this higher level of respectability, or should be understood to find his associates among butchers and bakers, was a new question on which tradition threw no light. His being a bachelor was in his favor, and would perhaps have been enough to turn the scale, even if Mr. Edward Freely's other personal pretensions had been of an entirely insignificant cast. But so far from this, it very soon appeared that he was a remarkable young man, who had been in the West Indies, and had seen many wonders by sea and land, so that he could charm the ears of Grimworth Desdemonas with stories of strange fishes, especially sharks, which he had stabbed in the nick of time by bravely plunging overboard just as the monster was turning on his side, to devour the cook's mate, of terrible fevers which he had undergone in a land where the wind blows from all quarters at once, of rounds of toes cut straight from the breadfruit trees, of toes bitten off by land crabs, of large honors that had been offered to him as a man who knew what was what, and was therefore particularly needed in a tropical climate, and of a Creole heiress who had wept bitterly at his departure. Such conversational talents as these, we know, will overcome disadvantages of complexion. And young Towers, whose cheeks were of the finest pink, set off by a fringe of dark whisker, was quite eclipsed by the presence of the sallow Mr. Freely. So exceptional a confectioner elevated the business, and might well begin to make disengaged hearts flutter a little. Fathers and mothers were naturally more slow and cautious in their recognition of the newcomer's merits. "He's an amusing fellow," said Mr. Prettyman, the highly respectable grocer. Mrs. Prettyman was a Miss Fothergill, and her sister had married a London mercer. "He's an amusing fellow, and I've no objection to his making one at the Oyster Club, but he's a bit too fond of riding the high horse. He's uncommonly knowing, I'll allow, but how came he to go to the Indies? I should like that answered. It's unnatural in a confectioner. I'm not fond of people that have been beyond seas, if they can't give a good account how they happen to go. When folks go so far off, it's because they've got little credit nearer home, that's my opinion. However, he's got some good rum, but I don't want to be hand and glove with him, for all that." It was this kind of dim suspicion which beckleted the view of Mr. Freely's qualities in the maturer minds of Grimworth through the early months of his residence there. But when the confectioner ceased to be a novelty, the suspicions also ceased to be novel, and people got tired of hinting at them, especially as they seemed to be. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.